days, as was Kao. In addition to being astrologically compatible, Yule and Reed actually looked quite a bit like each other. Reed messed with audiences by introducing Yule as his brother. He also turned over lead vocal performances to Yule on some new songs, especially on recordings, to overcome the limitations of his own voice and utilize the sweetness of Yule's delivery. For later generations of Velvet Underground fans, it comes as a shock to discover that some of the great songs on the self-titled fourth LP and the swan song Loaded feature Yule's voice, not Reed's. Though primarily a guitarist, Yule agreed to play bass. Less than 24 hours after accepting the job, he was in New York, staying up all night with Reed, learning 30 VU songs. "I thought it was really interesting that the first song they performed was Heroin," Steve Nelson said of VU's December 1968 shows, their first post-Kale dates in Boston. "They were sort of saying, 'We're still the Velvet Underground. Take this. Go fuck yourself.' It was great. Crowds still loved it." Most nights at the tea party ended with a large pile of money on the office desk. But Ray Reepin wasn't taking all that much home after expenses. Desperate to turn an otherwise total success into a profitable business, Reepin hired an ambitious BU student named Don Law to replace Steve Nelson as manager in the summer of 1968. Law seemed to be full of ideas how to expand the business. That first night he came in wearing beige chino pants and a powder blue button-down collar shirt, employee Betsy Politon says, recalling the staff's initial suspicion that Reepin had ruined things by hiring a square. But Law genuinely loved rock and roll, and under his direction, UK acts from Jeff Beck to Led Zeppelin came to play the club. These groups couldn't yet pack stadiums stateside, but the creation of mid-sized ballrooms in Boston, New York, and San Francisco made it feasible for them to cross the ocean for a visit. Van Morrison could technically be considered one of these UK imports, save for the fact that he could walk from his apartment to the tea party. At the first Van Morrison controversy show that Law booked there, the building almost burned to the ground. "I'm on the floor, and all of a sudden I look up as Van Morrison is singing, and there are flames coming through the fan above his head," Law says. He and Mitch Blake grabbed fire extinguishers and raced up the stairs that led to the roof ladder. Morrison, who clearly noticed the blaze, had the presence of mind to keep singing, a song no less about climbing a ladder. And as the two men put out the fire, a cocktail of water, foam, and debris rained down on the band. After the concert, a stoned audience member approached Morrison and Law, making it clear they had mistaken the fire and its extinguishing as part of the light show. Jonathan Richman finally found the nerve to perform songs in front of other people later in 1968. "I knew I couldn't play or sing like the other guys," Richman recalled. "I figured I had a feeling, and that was enough. I knew I was honest." Sometimes Richman didn't even have a guitar, according to Willie Alexander, who saw an early performance at one of the free Sunday afternoon concerts on Cambridge Common. He would just sing on top of him hitting his fucking baseball glove for percussion. "People thought he was wonderful. I thought he was completely out to lunch. And that was a good thing." 4 years later, in 1972, Richman would record an album for Warner Brothers with his band, The Modern Lovers. John Cale produced most of the tracks. The result was a rock touchstone, with Jonathan's peculiar but sincere songs backed by a banging band. Future Talking Head, Jerry Harrison on keyboards, future Carr, David Robinson on drums, and future lawyer Ernie Brooks on bass. The Modern Lovers wouldn't see release until 1976, and in the intervening years, something made Richman swear off electric instruments and his dedication to glorious, droning, velvet-style noise. A dream or vision a la Van Morrison. I don't think it was so much that he was getting tired of the old songs as he was developing this idea that the whole rock and roll star-making machinery was corrupt, bandmate Ernie Brooks recalled. And part of that was the whole system of burning fossil fuels to generate electricity, using a lot of power for amps and sound systems, playing stadiums. You know, feeling that there was something wrong in profiting from all these things. And he started tying it all together in his mind and decided that he didn't want the Modern Lovers to be a conventional rock and roll band. The combination of Jonathan's complete sincerity and the strange reasons he was doling out to explain the change made it hard to understand exactly what was happening. The band has to learn volume and to play softer, Richmond said in 1973. Otherwise, infants wouldn't like us because we hurt their little ears. And I believe that any group that would hurt the ears of infants, and this is no joke, sucks. Even decades later, at a 2016 acoustic show at the Middle East Club in Cambridge, Richmond stopped the show midway through to inform the sound engineer that he could still hear a slight electric hum in the room, and could anything be done? The first incarnation of the Modern Lovers did not survive Richmond's transformation into a full-blown nature boy. Robinson, who would later co-found the Cars, recalled an obsessed Richmond wanting to do shows on street corners and rest homes, asking that he play a rolled-up newspaper by banging it against my fist. Even in their home away from home, some people simply hated the Velvet Underground. The Globe complained about their headache-making and ear-splitting music, while Boston After Dark noted that they performed like automatons, with a fairly lackluster attack and endings that broke off like racing cars hitting a brick wall at full tilt. Elsewhere, reviewers complained that they dressed sloppily in sweatpants or expressed disbelief that their drummer was female. An honest-to-goodness chick playing percussion, do you believe it? MIT's The Tech asked incredulously. Conversely, in late 1967, the Boston Herald Traveler ran a positive profile of Maureen Tucker with the headline, "She gave up computers to play drums in band." A regular 9-to-5 job was too confining, Tucker told reporter Laura White. I felt mentally as well as physically captured by machines. At one VU Tea Party show in 1968, Tucker opened their set alone with a 15-minute drum solo. She just commanded the stage, commented one witness. She was really quite an impressive display. But it wasn't just the overly dramatic Wayne McGuire spreading the gospel of the Velvets in Boston. The height of VU evangelism could be found in Fusion, a nationally distributed magazine published out of Boston. Its editor, Robert Soma, formerly of Crawdaddy, was one of the band's pet writers, and in April 1969 praised their third album as technically perfect. He even recorded some voiceovers for radio spots promoting that very same record. Soma socialized with the band whenever they performed in Boston, often joining them afterward at the Cambridge apartment of Ed Hood. On the edge of Harvard Square, 4 University Road was a magnet for scenesters. Peter Wolfe, Avatar writer Charles Giuliano, and Astral Weeks flutist John Payne all lived there. After a series of murders at the complex in the 60s, including one of the Boston Strangler deaths, it became known as the Murder Building. Hood was found dead in the same apartment in 1982. The case was never solved. The star of Warhol's 1965 film, My Hustler, Hood was a balding, intellectual, entertainingly bitchy man who was taking a stab at an English degree at Harvard. The gatherings contained the feeling of a transcendental salon. Seances, Soma calls them. In Jonathan Richmond's 1992 song about the band, he sang, "Wild, wild parties when they start to unwind. A close encounter of the thirdest kind." Over Chinese food, Reed would hold court and rave about theosophist Alice Bailey. Hood would balance a cocktail on his head and recite the opening of Paradise Lost. Doug Yule cryptically alluded to spending a lot of time together in strange places and strange situations, and Sterling Morrison enjoyed repeating a story about encountering a dwarf with a gun in Boston who threatened to kill him. It would all come to an end, sort of, in 1970, when Lou Reed abandoned the band he'd built, turning his back on the Velvet Underground and, for a while, on music altogether. He was supposedly displeased with the direction in which Steve Sesnick wanted to take the band, and might have been developing a new kind of competitive, unhealthy relationship with Yule as well. After his departure, Reed, 28, moved back to Long Island, where he worked for his accountant father as a typist for $40 a week. One night, Reed showed up unannounced at Soma's Ipswich apartment to get high and watch TV. As the stoned pair tuned in the film Fantastic Voyage, a movie about scientists converted into miniatures and injected into a body, Reed turned to Soma and gravely declared, "This is going to be very disturbing." Soma sensed Reed was going through a profoundly difficult time and made attempts to keep his creative juices flowing. To encourage Reed, he published some of his poems in Fusion. Like Morrison with his poem on the back of Astral Weeks, Reed's direct references to Boston were limited to verse, never finding their way into any of his VU or solo songs. And in the back, pornography too, distilled, that is, to Boston taste, Reed wrote in a piece about walking through the shops of Cambridge. In his Fusion poems from 1971, you can track his struggle to keep it together after leaving the band. In We Are the People, the magical rules of Alice Bailey's white magic seem turned against him. We are the insects of someone else's thoughts, a casualty of daytime, nighttime, space, and God. Reed was no longer seeing his own negative thoughts as bugs. Now he'd been demoted from God to pawn, a mere bug in some grander entity's vision. It would be 2 years before Reed took the stage again. Today, Robert Soma's life couldn't be more distant from the rock journalist profession that brought him close to Lou Reed in the late 60s and early 70s. Soma is currently a bankruptcy attorney at a law firm in Boston. In 2004, President George W. Bush appointed him as a federal judge, a position he held for 3 years. From the conference room of his office suite, there's an incredible view of Boston, including the Fort Hill Tower, where he spent a harrowing afternoon in 1971. Soma was once detained and harassed by the Fort Hill community after Fusion published a critical piece about the members' way of life. When the discussion turns to whatever happened to Mel Lyman, I mention that the FHC say he died in 1978. "If it came from them," Soma replies, "I'm not sure I'd believe it." In July 1969, Reepin and Law relocated the Boston Tea Party from Berkeley Street to a larger space across from Fenway Park on Lansdowne. The lack of "Praise Ye the Lord" above the stage wasn't the only difference. Fans and musicians thought that the new locale simply didn't contain the magic atmosphere that made the original room so special. Bigger acts like T-Rex, The Byrds, Led Zeppelin, and The Kinks all performed there. Still, Reepin could see that his financial plan for the club wasn't panning out. In 1968, he had sold $300,000 in public stocks, figuring that Boston's status as the quintessential college town would keep renewing the club's audience. But according to the Globe, the 1970s student strike protesting the Vietnam War caused admissions to plunge, with the fiscal year ending in May showing a $40,000 loss. "The only people who made money out of this," one Tea Party stockholder grumbled, "are the rock musicians themselves." The artists were demanding higher guarantees. It was impossible for the Tea Party to go back to the smaller-scale bands it used to host on Berkeley Street. In its last months of operation, the club hosted everyone from traffic to Little Richard, who brandished a pistol in the presence of Don Law after an impossibly energetic performance, demanding prompt payment be deposited into a glittering suitcase. On December 29, 1970, Sha-na-na headlined the Boston Tea Party's final show. They say I was some eccentric lawyer with a seedy Midwestern accent, a rube that all of these clever people use to get rich, Reepin says. But let me tell you, there wasn't anybody that dreamed of any fucking thing like the Tea Party in Boston when I got there. Manager Steve Sesnick found no cause for the Velvet Underground to split just because Lou Reed was gone, and the rest of the members agreed at first. Then Sterling Morrison quit after a show in Houston, and Ewell recruited Walter Powers and Willie Alexander, whom he'd left behind in the Grass Menagerie. Mo Tucker, the sole original Velvet, hung on through the early 70s. At a show in 1971, David Bowie excitedly talked to Doug Ewell for 15 minutes, only later learning it wasn't Lou. Ewell later said that the trouble all started with Sesnick. I was like a kid thrown into the deep end of a pool and told to swim, he said. The manager took advantage of the fact that the members of VU had a habit of not talking things over among themselves, allowing him to divide and conquer. I would be told by him that I was better than Lou, and that the others were not really my friends, Ewell said. You can't con someone unless they're greedy, Ewell admitted. And I was real greedy. Willie Alexander, now in his 70s and living in Gloucester, shows me a cheat sheet scribbled with song titles, the total information he received hours before playing his first VU show. A chord progression ends with the directive, "Watch Walter." A note at the bottom reads, in Ewell's handwriting, "Fuck it. Fake it." That was what I had to go on, Alexander says. Some people thought I was John Cale. Thus, the Velvet Underground transformed from a groundbreaking New York art rock group into a better-than-average bar band from Boston. Like a ghost ship sailing through the club circuit, they burned off any excitement still attached to their name. Before Lou Reed resurrected the band in 1993, the Velvet Underground's final performance was at a ski lodge in Vermont, featuring no original members. The audience kept asking Ewell to turn down the volume. Chapter 6. Scenes from the Real World. The five men, identically dressed in gray suits, straw Stetsons, and dark glasses, had never met before, but their actions had been planned in advance. In the basement of the Boston Mercantile Bank on Congress Street, two guards were transporting sacks of cash into the vault when the men sprang into action. Two of them stepped off the elevator, guns drawn, forcing customers to sit along the wall, while the other three disarmed the guards. A woman in a business suit screamed. As more customers unwittingly stepped off the elevator and into the crime scene, one of the robbers shot a hostage in the ankle as a warning. The cart full of cash was wheeled toward the exit. As the mystery men left, one of them rolled a canister toward the huddled hostages. An enormous cloud of pink smoke filled the hallway. Outside, a sixth man sat in a station wagon. One by one, the five others left the bank, tossing two sacks each into the car, then dispersing. Across the street, on the 10th floor of an office building, the mastermind watched through binoculars. It was the largest heist in Boston since the 1950s Brinks robbery, and it had all gone off without a hitch. Screenwriter Alan Trustman wasn't surprised. He had been planning it for more than 20 years. Trustman was born in Brookline in 1930. At 15, he got a summer job at the First National Bank in downtown Boston, where he sorted checks all day and imagined pulling off the perfect heist. As an experiment in theft, he had a friend cash a $100 check, which he removed from his alphabetical sorting and shredded. Check cashed, Trustman returned the money and informed his bosses of the security hole. They knew such a scheme was possible, but decided it would cost far more to install preventive measures. They didn't fire him. After graduating from Harvard Law School, Trustman was hired at Nutter, McLennan & Fish, where his father was a partner. From his corner office, Allen could look down at the First National Bank of Boston. His heist fantasies returned with a vengeance. But instead of committing a felony, he turned his idea into a screenplay, pounding out the Crown Caper over the course of 7 Sundays in 1967. Without any connection to the movie business, he naively sent the result to Alfred Hitchcock. Amazingly, Hitchcock's assistant read it, liked it, and phoned Trustman. She explained that in order to get his script in front of a reputable director, he needed an agent. Trustman had his firm's best switchboard operator flood the lines at William Morris until an agent agreed to speak with him. The man who took him on, John Flaxman, was a fan of Norman Jewison's recent movie, The Russians Are Coming. Flaxman met the director at the airport in New York before a trip, handed him Trustman's script, and told him to make a decision within 10 minutes of landing in Los Angeles. Somewhere over the Midwest, Jewison knew that his next motion picture would be The Thomas Crown Affair. Soon after, during scouting visits to Boston, Jewison learned just how close the title character was to its author. When Jewison suggested certain details of the heist were unbelievable, Trustman brought him to the actual bank and walked him through each robber's route. "He was incredulous that no one stopped us, asked us anything, or paid any attention to us. I looked like a bank employee, but Norman had a California tan, an expensive camel hair non-Boston coat, and non-Boston sideburns well below his ears," Trustman says. Jewison signed up, and Steve McQueen was keen to play the title role. He didn't strike the director as a natural fit. "The character wears suits, Steve." But since Jewison's last picture with the actor, McQueen had become the world's biggest box office draw. McQueen, who had never worn a suit, even in a film, made an impassioned pitch and got the part. Trustman balked. How could this thug, this biker, this dead-end kid play his Boston Brahmin thief? At Jewison's urging, Trustman screened McQueen's oeuvre, cataloging everything he liked to do, everything he did not like to do, everything that made him comfortable, and everything where he looked stiff and frozen. He McQueened Crown's lines, capping each at 6 words, and added scenes where the character zoomed around in a dune buggy. McQueen loved it. Thrilled by the prospect of a Steve McQueen picture being filmed in town, the mayor's office gave Jewison plenty of support. But this didn't guarantee a smooth shoot in public locales, as reported in a 1977 Boston Magazine article. For a scene on Beacon Hill, just as Jewison had called action, a patrolman strolled into the shot and told the crew they couldn't film there. "But we have permission from the mayor's office," a production assistant insisted. "You've got to go through district headquarters," the cop said, dumbfounding Jewison and the crew. To lose a day's shoot to get the official permit would set the production back $90,000. You don't have to read too hard between the lines of the story to grasp how things were resolved. A production assistant and the officer took a stroll around the block. When they returned, production was resumed. Throughout filming, cameras were concealed during public shoots to capture more natural performances from the actors and background extras. When it was time to film the movie's climactic robbery, there were very few indicators a shoot was underway. Our heisters scared a lot of customers and pedestrians who thought they were seeing a real robbery, Jewison told the Boston Globe. But oddly, no one tried to interfere. I think they were afraid of getting involved. McQueen was playing a fictional version of Trustman, and there were times during production when the lines between the two men became blurred, even competitive. I had recently bought a new suit, which I used to do every 5 years. It was a very nice suit, and I was wearing this suit on the set. Suddenly, Steve McQueen stormed off, a tantrum, as Trustman described it, refusing to film his next scene. Norman Jewison quietly pulled Trustman off to the side and told him, "He says your suit is better than his. I think it would be helpful if you left." Trustman was in shock. McQueen didn't even like wearing suits. After spending months turning Trustman's fantasy into a kind of reality, the production wrapped and the Hollywood filmmakers exited Boston. For the writer, it must have been like waking from a dream. There was no evidence left behind of the events that had just transpired. The heists, the famous endless kiss between McQueen and co-star Faye Dunaway. Had any of it really happened? It was a question that arose again and again across 1968, as daydreams and brutal reality alike became fodder for the silver screen. Boston is celebrating a big bank robbery this week, the Globe reported on June 16th. The all-day premiere gala kicked off with the presentation of the Thomas Crown Purse to the winner of the sixth horse race at Suffolk Downs, followed by a party on a yacht, a cocktail reception at the New England Aquarium, and a parade downtown. McQueen arrived via helicopter. "Think of it," Norman Jewison told an interviewer. "A movie shot in Boston. Nobody ever shoots movies in Boston." The film drew mixed reviews. Pauline Kael called it a chic, crappy movie, possibly the most underplotted, underwritten, over-photographed film of the year, Roger Ebert declared. Which is not to say it isn't great to look at. Made for $4.3 million, the film grossed $14 million, and Bostonians were delighted to see their city in a major Hollywood production. During the premiere, the crowd cheered and gasped as much for tense plot points as for cameos by local residents. Of course, many extras were annoyed by their absence from the finished product. "They cut off my face, but you can hear me all right," one insisted. Trustman scored again with his script for Bullet, also starring McQueen later that year. But he didn't enjoy the celebrity. Boston papers covered his messy divorce, and keeping his on-screen avatar happy could get tricky. Trustman refused McQueen's order to write him a screenplay in which the main character was a loser. His output devolved into B-movies. The phone stopped ringing. "Movies are commercially packaged dreams," Trustman would later write in The Atlantic. "And as long as people are packaging dreams, other people will pay the price to open the package and see the dream." Some dreams are nightmares. Another major motion picture emerging from the city that year grew not from a pleasant reverie, but from a waking horror. Between 1962 and 1964, 13 women in the greater Boston area were murdered in their homes, without any sign of forced entry. The papers attributed the crimes to the Sunset Killer, the Phantom Stranger, and the Mad Strangler, before the simplest moniker won out, the Boston Strangler. Even after the media warned them never to open their doors to strangers, the murders continued. "Hysteria solves nothing," one Boston Herald headline read, stirring up more hysteria. Landlords installed bigger, better locks. Some women acquired tear gas or guard dogs. Others packed up and left town. And in a city where the Watch and Ward Society had primly banned suggestive entertainment for years, the crimes of a sexual deviant must have been particularly unsettling. The murders were still happening when the first dramatization surfaced in 1964. Victor Bruno starred in The Strangler, whose title character the New York Times described as a corpulent young man with a fetish for dolls and fingers that tingled toward the opposite sex. The film stoked the tangible aura of fear in Boston, floating wild guesses as to the type of sicko responsible. Next up, the true crime literary version. My interest was not so much in writing a book about the Boston Stranglings as it was to write about what happens to a great city when it is besieged by terror, author Gerald Frank wrote in the preface to 1966's The Boston Strangler. While accounts of real-life atrocities have always found readers, it's around this time that a subgenre emerged, the true crime non-fiction novel, most often credited to Truman Capote's 1965 bestseller In Cold Blood. Right on its heels, though, was Frank's book, and its loose ends made for an even more chilling read. If the reader is left feeling that there is more to be known, that the authorities are not quite satisfied, one review read, it is only because such is the case. Frank rooted his story in first-hand accounts and interrogation transcripts. By the second half of his investigation, there was a likely suspect in custody. Shortly after, Chelsea, Massachusetts native Albert DeSalvo confessed to being the one and only Boston Strangler, he signed a release granting Frank exclusive and perpetual rights to publish biographical material about him. DeSalvo was born in 1931. His father beat everyone in the family and regularly brought home prostitutes, making no attempt to hide them from his children. Albert's early forays into shoplifting and animal torture led to reform school. Afterward, he joined the army, meeting his wife-to-be, Irmgard, in Germany before settling in Malden, Massachusetts. The couple had two children together, and he appeared to be a doting husband and father. But DeSalvo led a disturbing double life. It started with the Measuring Man incidents. In this ruse, DeSalvo showed up unannounced, claiming to be Johnson from the Black and White Modeling Agency. He complimented the woman who answered the door, took her measurements, and promised her modeling work before parlaying the moment into sex. The success of this bizarre scheme speaks to DeSalvo's natural charm. Next came the Green Man crimes, in which DeSalvo donned a green workman's jumpsuit and pretended to be a maintenance man, gaining access to women's apartments and raping them. "I'm not good-looking, I'm not educated, but I was able to put something over on high-class people," DeSalvo explained upon his capture in 1961. "They were all college kids, and I never had anything in my life, and I outsmarted them." DeSalvo often said strange things to his victims, suggesting a man in agony over his compulsions. Once, running out of a victim's apartment, he yelled, "Don't tell my mother!" Sometimes he would go home and cry like a baby as he watched his crimes reported on TV. But it's what happened after his admission to the Green Man crimes that triggered a lifetime of second-guessing. In October 1964, DeSalvo broke into a Cambridge house and sexually assaulted a newlywed. He was arrested and sent to Bridgewater State Mental Institution for an evaluation. There DeSalvo began dropping cryptic comments and boasts. One doctor noted he was a manipulative attention grabber with an extensive need to prove what a big man he was. "I'm known as the Green Man now, but soon I'll be known by another name," he told a social worker. The following March, DeSalvo confessed to being the Boston Strangler to an up-and-coming lawyer named F. Lee Bailey. There are three prevailing theories regarding his confession. One, he was the killer, or one of the killers, and couldn't resist taking credit. Two, he lied about it for attention. Three, he was encouraged to confess by his ward mate, George Nasser, a criminal with a high IQ, who some believed committed the murders himself. State Assistant Attorney General John Bottomley, chief of the Boston Police Strangler Bureau, arrived at Bridgewater to interrogate DeSalvo. In the opinion of one Bridgewater doctor, DeSalvo had a legitimate photographic memory and thus had no problem doling out details to Bottomley. Was DeSalvo vividly recounting memories, or just stories he had been told? Adding to the murk was the fact that Bottomley had never conducted a criminal investigation in his life. While getting inside DeSalvo's head, he was also unwittingly providing the man with new information. Published in late 1966, The Boston Strangler was an instant bestseller. It took readers right up to the moment when DeSalvo was judged competent to stand trial for the Green Man crimes. Outside of his confessions, there was no substantial evidence with which to try him for the stranglings, but the Green Man trial would serve as a proxy for strangler guilt in the public's mind. This is precisely what DeSalvo wanted, it seemed. The notoriety without the electric chair. In his mind, the sale of his life story as the Boston Strangler would support his family forever and make him a star. If a man was the Strangler, the guy who killed all those women, DeSalvo asked, would it be possible for him to publish his story and make some money with it? The Green Man conviction, the exhaustive news coverage, and Frank's bestseller all shaped public perception. What cemented it was The Boston Strangler, the 1968 film based on the book. It was in many ways far more damning than Frank's scrupulous account, removing all doubt about DeSalvo's guilt. Arriving in the fall of 1968, The Boston Strangler would be America's first trial by movie. Director Richard Fleischer initially hired acclaimed British playwright Terence Rattigan to work on the Strangler script, but the result was unfilmable, to say the least. Instead of detectives using brain work to collar the killer, a computer generates the name of the suspect, Daryl Zanuck, the same name as one of the founders of 20th Century Fox, for some reason. Rattigan also raised eyebrows when he repeatedly asked Gerald Frank about the size of DeSalvo's penis. Rattigan was replaced. Fleischer went with an unexpected actor for the lead. What's a nice guy like Tony Curtis doing strangling women, even if it is only a film, one newspaper joked. Fleischer had a discomfiting take, claiming the star has the same attractive personality, the same appealing charm that could allow a man to talk his way into any woman's apartment. Curtis, 42, had made his name in both comedy and drama over his career, but the drag blast Some Like It Hot became his calling card after its release in 1959, and by the mid-60s he wasn't finding parts with gravitas. I wanted to play DeSalvo so much I would have spent 3 years in jail as compensation, Curtis said. In lieu of the slammer, Curtis gained 15 pounds, studied medical records, wore ankle weights to alter his gait, and installed brown contact lenses. He visited crime scenes and devoured all the coverage. The actor was in the middle of a divorce. A shy girl from Cambridge was spending a lot of time at his suite. His accent was passable. The film was already behind schedule. There's a little bit of a Boston Strangler in everyone, Tony Curtis would later declare. Fleischer was flummoxed when the police announced their refusal to assist the on-location shoots. Additionally, Boston's finest forbade the use of real police cars and uniforms and wouldn't let the designers photograph the inside of the police station to make replicas. There were more difficulties afoot, including the fact that no one knew how explicit the movie could be. Fleischer would shoot a scene for maximum gruesomeness, then again in a tamer fashion, in case the censors were looking to snip. Meanwhile, others hinted that lawsuits might be ahead, depending on how the film turned out. Attorney General Edward Brooke made it clear that if the script did not accurately reflect his association with the case, there might be trouble. 20th Century Fox offered Brooke $50,000 to work on the film, then $100,000 to no avail. Edmund McNamara of the Boston Police Department was less subtle, threatening massive legal trouble if the movie even implied his existence. Attorney General Elliot Richardson said the film might adversely influence a future trial. John Bottomley, one of two actual participants who couldn't resist working on the film, protested this objection, pointing out that no public official in the movie explicitly says that DeSalvo is the strangler. Production wrapped in February, and the filmmakers traveled back to the West Coast. In the summer of 1968, Albert DeSalvo asked a judge if he could see the movie in advance of its release. The request was part of a preliminary injunction to prevent the film from being screened anywhere in Boston. When the film opened in October, the city didn't roll out the red carpet the way it had for Trussman and Jewison's Caper. Critics were frosty as well. There have been lots of movies about murders, but very few about real murders, using real names while they are still a daily memory for the living, Roger Ebert wrote. The problem here is that real events are being offered as entertainment. A strangler murdered 13 women, and now we are asked to take our dates to the Saturday night flick to see why. Unlike Frank's book, the movie version was a deliberate exploitation of the tragedy of Albert DeSalvo and his victims. As the camera closes in on Curtis's face one last time, Fleischer shoehorns a call to action. The film has ended, but the responsibility of society for the early recognition and treatment of the violent among us has yet to begin. Some writers fell for the messaging. The film is, although I hesitate in using this word, entertaining as an excellent character study, wrote a Daily Illini reviewer. And it surely does serve as a public service, not only for young girls threatened by social deviants, but for understanding the criminally insane. For Digby Deal at the Los Angeles Times, however, the movie set a shocking precedent for libel as entertainment. DeSalvo had not been found guilty of any of the actions he's shown carrying out in the film, Deal wrote, warning that anyone could stand next before the celluloid jury. Curtis, who so passionately believed the role would revive his career, must have been disappointed, but it went beyond bad reviews for the actor. Shortly after the release of the film, Curtis began to receive anonymous letters in the mail with cryptic messages. "You're not the Boston Strangler. I am." Albert DeSalvo sued for $2 million in damages after he was unable to prevent the film from screening in Boston. DeSalvo said the film portrays him as a vicious and depraved individual, and that it shows a reckless disregard for the truth, the Globe reported. Albert H. DeSalvo versus 20th Century Fox Film Corporation and the Walter Reed Organization would be the last time he appeared in a courtroom. It was during this case that certain testimonies called into serious question DeSalvo's identity as the true strangler. Bridgewater State Hospital's Dr. Ames Roby said he didn't believe DeSalvo committed the murders, calling him a very clever, very smooth, compulsive confessor who desperately needs to be recognized. But James Lynch, 20th Century Fox's lawyer, built a strong case, attempting to show that DeSalvo approved the project and encouraged its creators, even making a leather wallet for director Richard Fleischer. DeSalvo and Detective Phil DiNatale, the only other real-life participant who assisted in the creation of the film, had exchanged many letters, one in which DeSalvo promised the detective complimentary tickets to see the movie. DeSalvo's lawyer insisted that his client be able to view the film, but the judge disagreed. Albert DeSalvo returned to Walpole State Prison to serve out his life sentence. On November 25, 1973, he placed a call to Dr. Roby, the Bridgewater psychiatrist who doubted Albert was the strangler. DeSalvo now wanted to entrust him with some important information. He would not tell him the specifics over the phone, so the doctor promised to visit him first thing the next morning. He was going to tell us who the Boston Strangler really was, and what the whole thing was about, Roby later said. The next morning, while preparing to head to Walpole, Roby saw the news on TV. Albert DeSalvo had been found murdered in his cell. Among his belongings, investigators found a poem that Albert had written. Here's the story of the strangler yet untold, the man who claims he murdered 13 women, young and old. Today he sits in a prison cell, deep inside, only a secret he can tell. People everywhere are still in doubt. Is the strangler in prison or roaming about? In February 1967, a month after Fox purchased the rights to Gerald Frank's book, Albert DeSalvo and two other inmates escaped from Bridgewater State Hospital. For 24 hours, the city of Boston was once again in the grip of strangler terror. His cohorts were caught drinking in a bar in Waltham. DeSalvo was found wearing a stolen sailor's uniform in a store in nearby Lynn. Upon capture, he told reporters that he had escaped to call attention to the terrible conditions at Bridgewater. "Maybe people will know what it means to be mentally ill," he said, calling out the insufficient rehabilitation tools offered to him at Bridgewater. While DeSalvo was criticizing the hospital on the nightly news, a few miles away, a former attorney named Frederick Wiseman was editing documentary footage he had shot at the same hospital the previous year. The finished product, Titicut Follies, would bolster DeSalvo's argument tenfold. Many of the politicians and doctors involved in the DeSalvo strangler case were also major players in the subsequent legal debacle surrounding Titicut Follies, and the documentary can seem like a shadowy real-life counterpart to the big-budget feature. Filmed at Bridgewater while DeSalvo was an inmate awaiting trial for the Green Man crimes, Titicut Follies kicked off Wiseman's unparalleled 50-year career as a documentarian. But for decades, you couldn't see it. In January 1968, the film was permanently banned from being screened in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts by Judge Harry Callis, who described it as a nightmare of ghoulish obscenities. Frederick Wiseman was a Yale-educated Boston University law professor before he dove into filmmaking. Almost 30 and bored with teaching, he began taking his students on field trips to Bridgewater State Hospital in the late 50s to show them how the state treated the criminally insane. It was a place where chaos had ruled for decades. In the 1880s, Bridgewater was a co-ed facility where inmates raised livestock and harvested crops. One historian wrote that convalescing patients mingled with violent ones. Inmates damaged much of the asylum property, the atmosphere was disorderly, and the patients were clearly not under firm control. A Globe profile from the early 60s called it a colony of lost men, noting that one patient had been picked up for vagrancy in 1901 and remained there ever since. Wiseman's interest in filming at Bridgewater had an anti-authority slant, but since the hospital was in dire need of renovations, Superintendent Charles Goggin supported the project, hoping it would force his superiors to see the difficulties his staff endured. The film would be about a prison and the people who are in it and those that administer it, Wiseman petitioned Governor John Volpe, promising that no people will be photographed who do not have the competency to give a release. After a year of meetings, Wiseman's three-person crew commenced filming in April 1966. Goggin was pleased that the movie men could capture some of the institution's annual spring talent show, known as Titicut Follies. Titicut was the Native American name for the land upon which the hospital was built. Because inmates and staff both participated in the hospital variety show and everyone is in costume, it's difficult for a viewer of the film to ascertain their real-life roles. This unsettling confusion is how the Finnish documentary begins. The guards, in general, welcomed Wiseman, but it was made clear that he was never to come into contact with Albert DeSalvo, who now, as the self-confessed Boston Strangler, was Bridgewater's highest-profile inmate, with a lawyer who complained about hospital conditions to the press on a daily basis. Goggins' deputy told Wiseman that if the director approached DeSalvo, he would personally belt him. "I don't think this constitutes censoring," Goggins said. After shooting 80,000 feet of film in 29 days, Wiseman began the arduous job of assembling the footage. The final 84-minute black-and-white film is a singularly powerful experience. No formal interviews, title cards, or soundtrack. Only a series of stark scenes conveying the terror and confusion of Bridgewater State Hospital. Patients are stripped naked, grilled about their masturbation habits, taunted by guards, and in one instance, force-fed through a tube. In August 1967, Tittacat Follies was accepted to the New York Film Festival. An early notice in the Saturday Review praised it as a startling example of film truth, while raising an ethical question: where does truth stop and common decency begin? Then came a chain of events that would hound the director for decades. Some little biddy from Minnesota wrote to Attorney General Elliot Richardson saying she read the review asking, "How can you allow something like this to happen?" Wiseman grumbled to Newsweek that fall. It's ironic that a filmmaker so lauded for documenting reality over the years started his career with a bitter legal battle in which prosecutors argued that he was distorting the truth. Wiseman claimed that all of the state's post-editing restrictions were never discussed. The state disagreed. He initially seemed to prevail. In late September, despite the efforts of the state of Massachusetts, Tittacat Follies screened at the New York Film Festival and began a commercial run at another New York theater. Wiseman's Follies were on the loose. The Avatar reviewer had a unique angle. He was a Bridgewater alum. The article, in issue 12, takes the reader through a beautiful New England town along a wooded path to a looming structure like a medieval castle. He mixes his own memories of his dark residency at Bridgewater with commentary on the film. "The doctor is like nothing I have ever seen before. His suit is a cheap flannel and most of his teeth are missing. What is left of his blonde hair is pulled back over his fleshy face. Have you ever had a homosexual experience? Sucking and fucking? Are you addicted to marijuana? Do you hate your mother? Your father? Obviously, you are a gentleman. It is too bad. I would like to have you as a guest at my house. We should drink wine and listen to Mozart. But unfortunately, I am not allowed to do that. I try to impress him with my lucidity. I never knew for sure how long I was in solitary. After several days, a fellow starts to talk to me. I am thrilled now to have a friend. I ask him questions. Soon, however, I realize that he is completely out of his mind. He is the third eye and sees into the minds of all men. But he is a human being, and I am so alone." Tittacat Follies was shot entirely in the F ward. This means that they concentrated on the men that are genuinely insane. We are allowed to hear only one man who raises doubts of his insanity. We are not allowed to see E ward, where at least half the men are fully rational. The therapy is Thorazine. At every meal, the guards come around and give out the pills. The men try not to take them because they realize that Thorazine means the sleepwalking death. Once you are on Thorazine, they take you deeper and deeper, always more Thorazine until there is no mind at all. Once every 2 weeks, you take a shower. Once a week, you get a glass of milk. once a week an orange, once a week a movie. What do you think of your mental condition? Dr. Roby asks. I do not wish to give an opinion, as I feel that I am under observation, and that my remarks may be construed against me. They look at each other and nod, as if in a show of hands vote. You are very sick. Prepare yourself for a long stay, but don't worry, we will cure you. The state won a temporary ban on Titicut Follies on September 22, 1967, and hearings on the matter began in October. Bridgewater's Goggin deplored the film's message of shock. Commonwealth versus Wiseman, like DeSalvo versus 20th Century Fox, constituted a tug of war over the right to show a movie, both questioning whether the participants had the mental awareness to sign a release form. During the testimony of John Marshall, Wiseman's primary camera operator, someone noticed that one person in the room acting as a member of the press was actually Timothy Ash, the second camera person for Titicut. Ash, it turned out, had been filming the entire proceedings. He was promptly accused of deception, and people theorized that Wiseman and company were making a new film about the trial of Titicut Follies. All of Ash's footage was going to be edited into a sequel, possibly titled Beacon Hill Follies, it was nervously conjectured. Or worse, intercut into the existing film to reveal a new layer of bureaucratic hypocrisy. This turn of events did Wiseman no favors. The trial now focused on three principal allegations against Wiseman: that he had breached an oral contract, perpetrated a gross invasion of privacy, and intended to profit from the film. The real privacy sought to be protected in this case, Wiseman's lawyer argued in court, is the privacy of Massachusetts not to be made a laughingstock. A Globe op-ed agreed, saying that the film causes rational middle-class people to confront their own lack of abiding concern for the fate of Bridgewater's unfortunates, and therefore stirs the deepest pangs of guilt. Could it be that this is the central reason why the movie has met with such outrage in Massachusetts? When asked to explain the intent or effect of certain scenes in the film to the court, Frederick Wiseman time and again gave a five-word answer. The film speaks for itself. In January 1968, Judge Harry Callis ruled that Wiseman had breached an oral contract and invaded privacy rights with the creation of Titicut Follies, calling it 80 minutes of brutal sordidness and human degradation, and a piece of abject commercialism trafficking on the human misery of these unfortunate humans. It was the first ruling based on the right to privacy made in a Massachusetts courtroom, and set a chilling precedent for documentary filmmakers. On the contract issue, the judge simply believed the state over me, Wiseman told Vice magazine in 2007. He also declared the negative should be burned. The negative was spared, but Titicut Follies was permanently banned from being shown in Massachusetts. Later that spring, Judge Callis extended that ruling to apply anywhere outside of the state as well, essentially sentencing the movie to life in a vault. A few months after the ruling, a film starring Tony Curtis portraying a supposed mass murderer opened nationwide. The Boston Strangler was free to disseminate misinformation for profit, but Wiseman's film, one that could actually trigger positive social change, had been rendered invisible. Even after a new hospital was built in 1974, Bridgewater Superintendent Goggin maintained his opinion that Titicut Follies hurt more than aided the institution. Wiseman, who later said that he never had political motivations for creating the film, was pleased to learn about the improvements at Bridgewater. In the ensuing decades, Wiseman made numerous appeals to free his debut film, all failures. But after Wiseman came upon a headline in the mid-80s that read, "Titicut Follies Judge Dead," he began a fresh, aggressive campaign. In 1990, a judge ruled that Tittacat Follies was protected by the First Amendment and could be publicly screened. Tittacat Follies had escaped.